Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
By Dr. Nicely, and in the company of Dr. Margarita Danischer. Dr. Danischer has a resume like a patchwork quilt, and I want to say that it's made of the most disparate and yet beautifully combined elements, starting from a family who were affected in the Hitler years by the diaspora, and then a transition from Scotland on one side and Berlin on the other to the United States, where she was born. That was where she picked up her second passport, afterward making herself into first a Schweizerin, somebody from Switzerland, and then with a second marriage into an Austrian. And all the way along, she's been involved in not just medicine, not just her particular speciality, which is the training of persons to eat who, through misadventure or through psychological disorder, have never really learned how or have forgotten how. I said, not just medicine, but also music. Music in all its forms. She went to a musical gymnasium in Zurich, where she was reared, and has had musical people both up and down in the genealogic line, grandparents, and now even grandchildren, all of whom are involved in music. So she brings a rich background to the topic for today, which will not, unfortunately, touch so much as we might like on music, but instead on tube weaning, tube feeds, tube weaning, how this is to be accomplished, and how is it best to be accomplished. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex, for these very intriguing questions. I think there are two things I became aware of as a young doctor. And the one was, at the time when I started my pediatric training, I had just had my second of six children, and I was doing night duty. And on night duty, you wander through the hospital and you see the nurses doing their work with very little support, which you have during the day. And these nurses had the job to feed sick babies who were mostly unaccompanied in the 80s. And I witnessed what we would today call force feeding. And I was really, really, in a very motherly, personal way, I was shocked and I was upset. And I kind of understood that this can't help the child. So I became somehow interested in what is going on in the night with sick children who are left on the ward with no emotional support. So I talked to the nurses and I was told that even the child was screaming, the nurse was crying. The whole procedure was totally ineffective because at the end the child would go and 200 milliliters and 20 minutes of feeding were spat out in one moment. So I kind of investigated, why are they doing that? And they told me, the head nurse said, that's how we are taught in the school. Children must eat, even if they don't want to, and we must perform this force or this effort, even if we know intuitively that this can't somehow be good.
Nothing, and no gavage, no temporary insertion, no. And of course, feeding gastrostomy, feeding jejunostomy were not part of the repertoire.
Not yet. But in the early 80s, I started my pediatric training in 81, where the revolution of the venous drips had just happened from vena sectio to small lines. So all these children actually got a venous drip to you know, support them basically. But feeding was not a matter which was any of your business as a doctor. So it became, I was somehow this crazy young mother doctor who was getting interested in something which was not my business. And there was a lot of hostility and...
It's the perfect way to make progress. It is to break the rules.
Yes. And I actually, one night, made a little film. We introduced filming of interaction. I have two professional expertise. One is being a pediatrician, and I came from child surgery and neonatology. And the other one was being a gestalt psychotherapist. So I was always fetched when there was a crazy mom, or an upset mom, or a mom who was observed as being intrusive to her child. They called me. So one night I filmed such a scene and I told the head nurse, this is institutional abuse, what's going on here. Please stop it. And she didn't understand what I was talking about, but she noticed that I was so upset that she didn't want the whole situation to go to the Spitalsdirektion. Yeah. So she told her whole team, the next morning, force feeding is stopped. And at that time, they were putting tubes in secretly during the night to get a plus in the weight, because yes, the gastroenterologist would used to scold the nurse if she didn't have a nice plus. So all these queer things were going on, and I just became interested in what is feeding in hospital? What is happening in feeding in hospitals? And one,
food is love, and yes, here these children are being misloved.
Yes, yes, yes. But you see, then at the beginning, the children who were given tubes were children of psychologically desperate parents who couldn't offer the gentleness which a child needs. But then the more tubes were given also to children who left neonatal ward as a ex-preemie, if the boss didn't realize that the child deserves to be discharged without a tube. In Germany, there was a big war in the neonatology about no tube goes out before 6 to 10 kilo. And the other one said, all my patients get discharged at term, which was about 2, 2.5 kilos, without a tube. So this ideological war was going on, and I just somehow became interested. I found it very interesting that in these international meetings, they were really fighting passionately about this thing. And then child surgery was not as developed, so the cardiologists also needed weight and size, so that Liga was pushed. And then we had the whole allied disciplines of psychology occupational therapy and physiotherapy and speech therapy, saying force is not going to get us there. So I somehow became the lady interested in the quality of feeding. And of course, it's not difficult today to understand that the quality of feeding correlates with the quantity of feeding. And this simple equation that the quality first has to be gentle, loving, supportive, sit in a good position, get your baby in a comfortable position, offer the bottle at an angle or the breast where the baby can manage. There's a whole lot of, really hundreds of things which can go wrong and hinder the process of drinking easily. Things have to be really all good. And so we started making video analysis of these dysfunctional feedings, and we were referred like a newborn baby of a psychotic mother, or a newborn baby of a mom who had lost 6 children and this was the first surviving, who of course was over nervous. And all these emotional background stories somehow come into the quality of the feeding session and affect the child who has the potential. It's not dysphagic, but it has the potential to drink normally. But given this stressed situation, the probability of going in the direction of refusing and saying, well, this is so stressful for me, I'll turn my head to the back and I'll retreat, I'll manage without a bottle. And then you get into this situation of the doctor said or the nurse said it must be 6 times 140 mils, and the mums get under pressure. And pressure plus expectation is definitely counterproductive. And that's how this whole focus of being interested in babies who were not doing it properly, or their mums were not able to help them to do it properly, that's how it really started.
I am immensely impressed not only by your initiative, but also by the tolerance, the acceptance, the willingness to give you free rein as a videographer in your work and in your analysis. Somebody in the Anstaltsdirektion, somebody at the top of the tree said, this holds promise. Let's go with it.
Yeah.
And where did you go with it?
Well, my boss understood. He came from hematology and oncology. He somehow saw that there was a need of our ward was called psychosomatic pediatrics, and we soon became specialized for eating problems 0 to 18. And he always said, I don't understand what you're doing, but tell me if you need anything. And we didn't ask for
the
expensive.
Best boss.
Yeah, he was wonderful. And he saw that the response of the parents was positive. And we didn't need much technology. So we got a video camera, which at that time was a huge machine on your shoulder. And we introduced like thorax röntgen, lung x-ray tomorrow 11 o'clock, rewrote on the chart, video analysis of feeding interaction tomorrow at 11 o'clock. So all my colleagues, it's a very big university hospital on child surgery and pediatrics, somehow gradually got used to us doing funny work or new things. Then we would write interaktionsdiagnostik instead of thorax lungenfunktion or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we just slowly introduced new technology into the classical pediatrics. And I met a group called World Association for Infant Mental Health in 1989. When my fourth child was 8 weeks old in Lugano. And this group, I suddenly realized I'm not alone in the world thinking that this topic is not dealt with properly. There's a huge international group of, at that time, about 2,000 international people dealing with two topics, 0 to 3 in age, and all disciplines involved. So we had, it was in Lugano, that conference at in summer of 89. And the specialists, there was Dan Stern there, and they were like infant analysts coming often from pediatrics, but had drifted into the developmental side in America. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of support from that time. And I also met a woman called Irene Chatour, who was the world adult psychiatrist on neonatal depression of mums, or postnatal depression. And she had all these failure to thrive babies of these mums. And she didn't know how to help the babies because she knew as a psychiatrist what to do with the mums.
Oh.
But she had this this worry, and that's how we got talking. And she became really, in the first years, I would say, my teacher into a new field, realizing that there is a huge literature, but that classical pediatric studies don't even touch this whole field. And whether you call it behavioral pediatrics or psychosomatics or infant psychiatry, it doesn't really matter. It's about integrating the relationship level and component into your pediatric observation.
I love this, and now I want to ask you to make a transition. I say, you're inside the door, you've opened the door to us, and now take us to how tube feeding became a concern.
Okay, that's very easy, because I'm fascinating how children learn. How do they learn to swim? How they learn to ride a bicycle? How do they learn anything? And it's a process. It's never a thing you wake up and you can do it. It's a process which needs prerequisites. And people think learning to eat is open the mouth when the spoon comes. But yes. It's not. Mm-hmm. It is wanting to have the food, understanding that that stuff can go into people, can make you feel happy, saturated, full, whatever. And tube-fed children have been irritated by months of tube feeding at the best. The best tube-fed child is just not vomiting, but is constantly saturated. And if things are not so good, it's sick. And if things are really bad, it vomits 40 times a day. And these are the children which came in which were referred to us. Tube-fed children don't know the feeling of hunger. So they don't know seeking anything. They don't know how smells can get you interested or get you sick.
Never hungry, of course.
Yes, never
always
hungry.
Being topped up.
Topped up as much as you can. Because very few tube-fed children are normal weight. Most, a third of them, we made a study a few years ago, are severely malnutritioned, even though exclusively tube-fed, because so much gets wasted through the vomits. And so you have to get this child hungry, on the one hand, and itself interested in wanting the food. Most children, for instance, with a PEG tube, they refuse and they avoid. They go into a fearful kind of state of, oh, leave me alone. This is too much for me, if you address them with food in the way a mother would. So what I realized also as a psychotherapist is that children learn easier from other children and it's less intrusive. So if a little child sitting there at 7 months on the floor sees another child crawl to a cookie, grab the cookie and then lick it and even bite it, that's what will motivate the observing child. I want to have that too. And not when the mother comes because it's 10 o'clock and wants to shove a jar into her. So you have to understand how learning to eat goes from seeing the food, understanding the food, wanting to grasp it, take it, hand, mouth, motor coordination. This is very important to get it in the central line. All neonatological nurses know this, that the hands have to be in the middle because this way you can't swallow. If you try opening your arms and going like that, you're not breathing and swallowing. So we get the hands in the middle line and we help the child itself. And that's why we call our program Early Autonomy Training, EAT, E-A-T.
Yes.
Makes sense. And the job was to get the parents, as we say, into the second line, give your child the chance to realize what the world trusts it or is confident for it to learn. And this happens in the group. You don't do single sessions with neither the children nor the mums nor the dads. You put the children into groups of 10 to 12 where different ages with children with different diagnoses and different abilities have a picnic on the floor. And the picnic's goal is not how much is each child eating today at 11 o'clock, but are they having fun with each other? And are they understanding that food can be pleasant? Because this is new to them. So you're kind of giving them a new cultural experience. And this parallel with reducing the tube feeds and helping the child not wake up
saturated. Develop hunger.
Yes. Works. And then the biggest job is taking this positive picnic atmosphere back home.
Oh my, yes.
For the parents, because the mothers are then alone again, are terrified again, are desperate, feel, oh, we've lost a little weight, what can we do? So empowerment of parents is one of our biggest work in the second phase. Get the dads in, who are much less stressed because they haven't been through so much frustration and suffering. And as children are geniuses in learning and they want to learn and they love it. So our task is just to remove everything which is not letting that learn process
happen. Get out of those kids' way. Get out of their way.
Yes.
I have enjoyed this immensely. And I've done a lot of podcasts, but I rarely wish that we had more time to go to keep on discussing, because we're not going to have a chance to deal with, for example, how this might apply to the anorectic, the adolescent. You're in Graz. You're based in Graz at least 2 weeks out of the month. I really hope that we can get you back to talk more about this approach to dealing with children and dealing with food. Well, I live in Hungary. Hungary rejoined the European Union at the time of the Pan-Europäische Picnic, when the wall came down and Hungarians and Germans mingled. And you've done all that in a single life, and included the United States as an early step in your trajectory. With that in mind, what have you chosen as your song?
Before I say my favorite song, I'd just like to say that if anybody is interested in reading into this theme, we have a website called notube.com. So it's like YouTube, but no tube, meaning noartificialfeeding.com. And you'll find the anorexia, the picky eaters, the ARFID, and the tube children, a lot of literature and information on this website. And my choice of song would be what we call in Austria the Europa Hymne, the song written by Ludwig van Beethoven, which has now been chosen as the European hymn, because I think in times as today, you can't do better than try to keep our countries and our aim and our respect about differences and different thinking together. And that's why I'd be very happy if you could play the Ode an die Freude.
So, Schiller's Ode to Joy, as arranged by Ludwig van Beethoven. Thank you.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Europa wird eins. Europe so different and yet all one.
Thank you very much, Alex.